past 10.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
This week we're exploring how Jane Austen became the literary icon and media brand we know today, as we chart the story of her rise to preeminence from humble family scribblings to Hollywood movies. By the early years of the 20th century, the cult of Divine Jane had seized Britain and America, and for the soldiers of the First World War, she came to represent an Englishness very far from the terrible realities of life in the trenches. Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon is read by Alice Krieger.
At the very beginning of the burgeoning of Austen's fame, the novelist Margaret Oliphant wondered how the author had achieved wider recognition. It is scarcely to be expected that books so calm and cold and keen, and making so little claim upon their sympathy, would ever be popular. She was surely right in thinking that Austen's novels were unlikely candidates for mass consumption and global fame. But Mrs. Oliphant was also right that such considerations would make very little difference to the growth of Austen's popularity. The widening audience was not for the novels so much as for the novels in combination with Miss Austen, and increasingly, Jane. In 1885, Jane Austen made it into the Dictionary of National Biography. The article was written by Leslie Stephen, who as early as 1876 had said, "I never knew a person thoroughly deaf to humour who did not worship Miss Austen. Hers seems to be the very type of that kind of humour which charms one large class of amiable persons, and Austenolatry is perhaps the most intolerant and dogmatic of literary creeds." But the coining of the term Janeite by Professor George Saintsbury in 1894 showed how widespread Austen fandom had become by then, far surpassing the sentimental cult of any other writer. The American novelist and critic W.D. Howells, himself an ardent Janeite, remarked in 1890 that "the story of Pride and Prejudice has of late years become known to a constantly, almost rapidly increasing cult, as it must be called, for the readers of Jane Austen are hardly ever less than her adorers. She is a passion and a creed, if not quite a religion." Religious imagery began to appear everywhere. Howells was the first to name the author the Divine Jane, and though he meant it semi-satirically, the sobriquet gained immediate currency. In 1900, the Earl of Iddesleigh proposed a magazine devoted entirely to Jane Austen, and in an article entitled The Legend of St. Jane, talked of his worship at various sacred spots. And George Saintsbury, Professor of English Literature at Edinburgh, had by 1913 disintegrated to the point of declaring himself proud to be an Austen friar, a knight, or at least a squire, of the Order of St. Jane. A cult needs relics, pilgrims, a priesthood, a shrine. Winchester was the only readily accessible pilgrimage site, and Americans the first palmers. They laid flowers on her gravestone and wandered up and down College Street trying to identify the house where Jane Austen had died. Octavius Lacroix, proprietor of the College Street tuck shop, was so annoyed at being asked whether his was the right building that he petitioned his landlords, Winchester College, to put up a tablet on the outside. "They never buy anything, and they waste my time," the disgruntled trader complained. However, a few months later, he was asking for the sign to be removed again. The Americans had been silenced, but now he had a new lot of time wasters in the shop, local people asking who Jane Austen was. The cult of Divine Jane provoked some violent reactions. Mark Twain found English literary taste and tradition oppressive, and Austen represented the worst of it to him. Emerson had had a similarly strong antipathy, accusing Jane of being sterile in artistic invention, imprisoned in the wretched conventions of English society, without genius, wit, or knowledge of the world. "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and hit her over the skull with her own shinbone." Twain never tired of railing against Austen or apparently returning aghast to her novels. "Whenever I take up Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility, I feel like a barkeeper entering the kingdom of heaven. I know what his sensations would be and his private comments. He would not find the place to his taste, and he would probably say so. The strength of Twain's feelings against Austen was also partly in reaction to those of his friend W.D. Howells, who had become something of a one-man Austenolatry machine. As editor-in-chief of the Atlantic Monthly, and later editorial writer for Harper's Monthly, Howells kept his fulsome praise of Austen ever before the public. Twain goaded him with letters. "Jane is entirely impossible. It seems a great pity to me that they allowed her to die a natural death." Austen's most ardent fans and most dispassionate critics in the late 19th century were American, including the writer who was later called Austen's literary son and heir, Henry James. In his essay, The Lesson of Balzac, James conceded that Austen was one of those of the shelved and safe for all time. But like the Brontes, the industry around whom appalled him, she had entered a zone of unreal and disproportionate attention. Overvaluation, he believed, does no one any good, and his chilliest remarks are reserved for that distorting agent, the special book-selling spirit. Publishers, editors, illustrators, producers of all the pleasant twaddle of magazines who have found their dear, our dear, everybody's dear Jane so infinitely to their material purpose, so amenable to pretty reproduction in every variety of what is called tasteful and in what seemingly proves to be saleable form. James wrote before the dawn of the Jane Austen tote bag and t-shirt, of course, and the saleability he refers to was limited to print versions of Austen's novels, magazine fillers, and a few stage productions. Nevertheless, pleasant twaddle about Austen was becoming unavoidable. None of the factors usually despised in women's literature, the love stories, the thoroughly domestic focus, seems to have stood in the way of their appreciation, for they took comfort in perceiving a controlling intelligence behind it, discriminating, generous, critical, and humorous. Cultural conservatives took this as evidence, not that women might have greater potential than was usually assumed, but that Austen was some sort of exception, almost an honorary man. It was no accident that Austen's appeal was recognized by this group during a period of rising feminism, and that her verbal restraint and quiet life began to be held up as examples of what the 1890s New Woman was threatening to overthrow. The growing number of educated, independent but poor, unmarried women in society was a worrying phenomenon. A challenge to male dominance of the professions, a threat to sound government if they succeeded in getting the vote, an affront to every traditional value. She came in very handily here as a model of a high-achieving woman in an unreformed society, who, far from complaining about the conditions of her own existence, or the rights of women generally, beamed her cheerful, contented disposition on all and sundry, and quietly got on with writing her charming books. If a great writer could cause so little disturbance and make so few demands domestically and professionally, what need ordinary women of any special treatment? But Austen could also be held up as an example by the opposite camp. In her feminist writings, Millicent Fawcett promoted Austen to independent young women of the working and lower middle class as an encouragement to them to be reminded how much good work had been done in various ways by women. George Gissing, the author of the 1890s anti-feminist bestseller The Odd Women, thought Austen's novels very healthy and recommended them earnestly to his sister as a part of a course of self-improvement. Both James Edwards' memoir and Jane Austen's novels were favourites for family reading circles and were considered eminently safe for girls. Actual girls showed a degree of scepticism about the relevance of Austen to their lives at the turn of the new century. In an article for Temple Bar in 1892 called A Girl's Opinion on Jane Austen, presumably solicited from the young author to test the zeitgeist, Edith Edelman protested that Austen's warmest admirers were found not so much among other young people as among savants and men of letters. It was this constant affection of the few and cultured still keeps her in the niche of the Temple of Fame. Emma Woodhouse only becomes bearable, Edelman believed, Somewhere about chapter 50. But we think on the whole that it was a pity Knightley didn't marry Miss Bates. We may congratulate ourselves that we live in the days when high schools, extension lectures, magazine clubs and lawn tennis have superseded sentiment, sensibility, hysterics and mutual confidences. Such schwärmerei we now leave to our German sisters. We also hope that the young lady who could describe herself as dotingly fond of music, and my friends say I am not devoid of taste, is as obsolete as the atrocities she committed in watercolours and the fringe and sofa cushions she worked in worsted and beads. The savants and clubmen and the ladies who sewed were all welcome to her. Part of the appeal of Jainism was its ingrained Englishness, which for cultural and linguistic reasons slowed the dissemination of her works in the non-Anglophone world. Xenophobic Jainites could take comfort in the thought that Austen's humour was so delicate and gossamer and all that, so finely ironised, that no translation could reproduce it. Even the best translation ensured that the essential Jane remained where she had always remained in life, in England. They would not have been pleased to discover one of the oddest corners into which Austen penetrated in the last decade of the century, the anarchist cells of Paris. Cells in two senses. Félix Fénéon, poet, essayist and bomber, was both a member of a tight-knit group of political extremists and an inmate for 4 months of the Mazas prison. It was there that he came upon Jane Austen. He was refused access to periodicals or books from outside due to the political nature of his crime, and had to rely on the prison library, in which the only works of literature considered innocuous as they were by women were some novels of George Sand and a book called Northanger Abbey by a dead Englishwoman. The book charmed Fénéon, who recognised in the author a sort of fellow traveller who could expose middle-class mores with a few deft strokes to devastating satirical effect. He was permitted to have a dictionary, and the inmate sat down to make a translation. Politically, Austen appealed to Fénéon as a critic of the bourgeoisie. Intellectually, she represented astringent anti-romanticism. Austen was here taking her place among the cosmopolitan, multicultural icons which appealed most to the artists and intellectuals shaping the coming age. By the time of the Great War, Jane had come to represent qualities that not only defined a sorely threatened English culture, but held out the means to repair it. Books were one of the very few solaces for the men at the front. 18th century authors were popular among soldiers. The effect was two-edged. Augustan writing comfortingly recalled an age of rationality, distant composure and pre-industrial calm, while the act of reading it in the grotesque context of trench warfare facing mortal danger generated its own kind of nihilist comedy. The trenches were full of Jainites, and the therapeutic potential of Austen's novels in wartime was recognised when they were chosen as salubrious reading for the wounded and prescribed as an aid to convalescence for the most severely shell-shocked soldiers. Thus, Pride and Prejudice, Emma, and Sense and Sensibility appeared at the top of a graded fever chart drawn up for use in military hospitals by an Oxford don exempted from military service. In this way, Austen's novels can be said to have seen active service themselves, and it is odd to think of how many damaged and dying men in field hospitals and convalescent homes might have swum in and out of consciousness to the sound or the memory of Divine Jane's words.
Alice Krieger was reading episode 4 of Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon. It was abridged by Polly Coles, produced by Clive Brill, and was a Pacificus production. And tomorrow we'll hear how Jane can be linked to anarchism, terrorism, and the National Trust at the same time here on Radio 4 Extra.
Join me, Mel Gedroich, each weekday afternoon on the 4 o'clock show as we hear more of the entertaining entries that have made the shortlist for Radio 2's 500 Words competition for writers aged 13 and under. And if they're anything like those that have been part of the fantastic 50 so far, we can anticipate more terrific tales by awesome young authors.
Hello, I am Miss Iglesias, the new maid.
Puffing out my chest, I raised my head in pride.
Call this art, Jamie Owen. A three-year-old could do better.
500 Words continues on the 4 o'clock show weekday afternoons on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock, good afternoon. And our drama in this hour will take us to the West Country for Thomas Hardy's tale of star-crossed lovers. When a lady discovers a handsome young astronomer on the lonely tower of her estate, a story of passion and sacrifice begins. And how on earth does a homing pigeon get home? Find out as we examine the sat-nav of pigeons in the 4 o'clock show with Mel in an hour. Science and romance are destined to collide now on Radio 4 Extra as two unlikely lovers sweep the heavens in Thomas Hardy's tale of Two on a Tower.
What a strange, raw pain it is to know that I will not see you grow into a young man, Joshua. If what I now fear is true, I know I will not be there with you to share your triumphs or to ease the inevitable disappointments that fate places in the paths of our lives. But though I have tried to fight it, time, my mortal enemy, has finally won. I've never been far from here. My heart revolves around this place like the earth round the sun. This tower, with the touch of its deathly stones, conjures for me the single regret of my life. And like all parents, I pray to a merciful God that the suffering of my life will be enough to ensure that yours is full of the joy that I was too frightened to grasp. And if you ever doubt that you have the strength to be true to your heart, then you must come to this tower and read these words.
Two on a Tower by Thomas Hardy. Adapted for radio by John Senn.
Mr. Fellows, could we stop? Do you see it? Over there, behind the wood. There stands a column.
You mean the old folly at the edge of the estate?
I cannot think why in the 6 years I have lived in Welland that I have never seen it before.
The locals know it as Rings Hill Spear. Sir Blunt's great-grandfather is said to have built it to his own design, in honour of his late wife.
What I know of my husband and his family gives me sufficient reason to doubt that, Mr. Fellows. Can we go there?
Oh, but look at that track, Lady Constantine. The carriage will never make it through the mud.
If we can't reach the tower, how then does the occupant?
Occupant? That tower hasn't felt the whisper of a human breath for nigh on half a century.
But that cannot be. Just now I caught a reflection from the roof.
Oh, no, ma'am. You're mistaken.
But I'm sure I'm not. This is a mystery as well as an adventure. Let us go there immediately.
It'll end in misery, ma'am. Walk on.
Dear Joshua, I must begin at the beginning. But how misleading the simple trajectory of cause and effect. You will discover in time that despite our best attempts to control our destiny, to control cause and consequence, the twists and turns of our lives are left to that capricious character, chance.
Look, the door is open now.
Wait here.
Well, that was quick. I said it over here.